Hello and welcome to Misbehave, the podcast where we explore human behaviour in a business context. Season 3 is all about behaviour at work, how people show up, how managers lead, and how organisations build high performance cultures. We're speaking with senior leaders to uncover the thinking that drives behaviour, the trends shaping management development, and the future of work in an ever-changing world. In this episode, we chat with Neil Morrison, Group HR Director at Severn Trent, about cutting through HR red tape to build workplaces that work for people, not just processes. Neil challenges outdated management norms, shares how to strip back bureaucracy, and explores how to create a culture that's both productive and human. We also dive into the future of work, especially for frontline workers, and the role of technology in making or breaking the employee experience. Well, welcome, Neil. We are so pleased to have you join us. I think probably a good place for us to start is you've talked about this need to rethink people management, the people experience. Let's start by, tell us a little bit about that thought process and where that's come from.
So I guess if you think about all of us, we spend so much time at work, and work is, you know, pretty fundamental to our experience of life. And I guess the thing that's always come to mind is, how do you make that experience the best possible thing for people? So yes, there's a financial transaction, you get paid in order to do work, and you know, all of that has to be right. But ultimately, how do you just create something that is enhancing to people's lives? And so much of the last sort of 20, 30, 40, 50 years, maybe even longer, in terms of management, has been about, how do you get productivity? How do you drive process? How do you get compliance? How do you, all of these things that are just, you know, even as I say them, I feel my heart drop, because they're basically, nobody gets any joy out of all of that stuff. And so one of the things I've kind of challenged myself and I kind of try and challenge others to do is to say, how can we re-engineer the experience of work so that you get all the productivity, you get all the efficiency, but you also get joy, so that people are coming out of it going, crikey, I love going to work every day. And, you know, if you speak to HR professionals, they'll all say, God, I hate all the process that's involved, and I hate all the bureaucracy that's involved, and I hate all the forms that have got to be filled. You speak to employees and they say, God, I hate all the process that's involved. I hate. You speak to managers and they say the same. You kind of go, well, something bonkers about all of this, because everybody hates the same stuff. So how do you take it out? How do you make less of that? And how do you create an experience where things get done more easily at work and people get more joy out of doing them? And that kind of, that feels like it should be relatively easy to do, but my God, it's probably much harder than that, isn't it?
For sure. And I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because the stuff that you're describing there almost can be a byproduct of, if people are happy at work, and it can be joyful, but also just turning up and wanting to be there, the productivity and some of the other stuff comes after that fact. I think it's an interesting concept, isn't it? Because often we're encouraged to think about the byproduct or the outcome of making a change, so those things get focused on, but not the how. I'd be interested to know, Neil, what your thoughts are on how can businesses make a shift towards that. What's your approach?
I think, your question is a really interesting one, because I think one of the lines that I always use is, what's the least that we need to do in order to get the outcome? So you know, if you think about an eggshell is a piece of minimal design that holds, you know, the egg inside. Is phenomenal because it is so thin, it's literally the least required sort of container for its purpose. And I don't think we necessarily do that when we think about work. So we go, oh, you know, we need them to complete this form, or we need 5 people to sign it, or 6 people to sign it, or whatever it is. And simply, if you can go back and say, so what is the least that I need to do in order to get the same outcome, or even a better outcome, then you can start to challenge each and every kind of process, every relationship, every meeting, every part of the stuff that gets in the way of work, because none of these things are actually kind of creating value. They're all about managing the process of creating value. And so that's, I think, the mindset that you need to do. So if you take performance management, it's one of the classic examples of this always, because performance management was created a science that has actually driven no difference in terms of performance whatsoever. And lots of people have got very rich and lots of people have got very, very, very depressed over the whole process. But you know, very, very simply, what are you talking about? You're talking about, you know, does someone understand what they need to do? Do they have the tools and the skills in order to be able to do that? Are they getting feedback that tells them when they're doing it well? And are they getting kind of advice when they're not doing it so well? That's basically the minimum of what we're trying to do. And yet we then pile in with lots of different processes, lots of different stages, lots of different technology, lots of different kind of conversations that lose the essence of what you're trying to do. So how do you get back to the most minimalist way of doing things, which ironically was what we used to do in the 1970s and 1980s until we introduced all of this stuff?
And I think that minimalistic bit is so important in organizations where people are so time poor, and especially that middle management layer that we're often needing to have those performance conversations, that they often have potentially not even 1 hour a week outside of operational work. You know, they're squeezing their management job, so to speak, into a delivery role. And actually, we then give them all these convoluted processes that often, I mean, I do a CPO role in addition to what we do at Perform, and we see that we are in the construction industry, and we've got most of the managers that we have in our business run projects, multi-million dollar projects, and they just don't have the capacity to think through often really complex things. I think that minimalistic approach, and also thinking, how do we make this quick for people to do? How do we make it where it's not something else that's going to require them to spend hours and hours trying to figure out how to do this? Because let's be honest, they just don't do it in the end. Can you give us any practical examples of what you've seen in your work where that focusing on the enhancement of people's lives and the joy has resulted in that productivity and performance gain, which almost seem to be at odds in lots of businesses?
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting because I would say that organizations are at different levels of maturity, and you've got to always start from where you are, right? So if you've got an organization that is, you know, has got decades of working one particular way, and you suddenly go, hey, we're going to work in a totally different way, you're probably going to crash the organization, which is not a great thing to do. So, you know, the best example I can give you is when I worked in the creative arts, in media. So if you think about people who are attracted to publishing in the media, they come into it because they want to do the work. They don't come into it because they want to be managers in general.
Creatives, aren't they?
Exactly. And so, you know, what we were constantly trying to do when I was working there was say, how do you free up more of their time in order to do the things that they want to do and the things that drive commercial value for us, acquiring books, editing books, selling books, printing, you know, all of those bits, rather than management process, which actually doesn't add to any commercial value. And so, you know, a really good example, if I take the performance management one again, just because it is the classic, is, you know, we started calling it the conversation. And basically all we had was it was almost like a doodle pad that people had in order to have a conversation. And in that doodle pad, there was questions that people could ask if they wanted to, that there were provocations, there were little light bulb moments, check-ins, whatever it was. We didn't collect them back in. We didn't ask for any confirmation that they'd been done. It was simply trying to facilitate a really good conversation between two individuals on a topic of work and performance. Now, that took out hours and hours and hours of process and unnecessary work and frustration and recording and data entry and all sorts of horrible stuff that just wasn't happening. You know, and there was absolutely zero evidence that it had any negative impact at all on the organizational performance. So what you could see was a real win in terms of time and efficiency and cost saving, and no discernible difference in terms of performance outcome. So you then go, well, it's massively unnecessary, isn't it? So stop doing it.
For sure. Just to play devil's advocate a little bit on that as a sort of a thought process. I mean, we know with certain behavioral strengths, some people respond really well to some structure and some process. And then there's other people who really would prefer to do everything without a process and have the flexibility to move about and have more of a free rein. So, I mean, I'm a massive believer because I'm the person who likes the free rein and the freedom. But what we do is kind of almost it's in between that, certainly when we're working with people, but also in our business, is that we'll have some basic structure. So a bit like what you're saying, have some odd questions to help guide some people if they need it. But for us, I think you can definitely do this stuff quickly and easily, particularly using, you know, it might be a really simple format. And we complete our stuff as we go. So it's done in the moment. It's not, and it's bullet pointed or it's words or it's something that you've got something to measure back to or reference point. And I think, you know, that I don't think it has to be all or nothing. I think there can be ways and means of finding the in-between for that, because for some people, the total lack of structure can actually cause more ambiguity and angst than having too much. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, so I guess my challenge back to that would be, we have so many relationships in life where we don't require that structure, or we take ownership of that structure ourselves. So any of us who've got caring responsibilities, we've got partners, we'll have all sorts of kind of feedback conversations on a regular basis with them that we don't necessarily need a form, we don't need a rating system, we don't need to record it in a, you know, and then check in 6 months later to see whether they've, you know, improved their ability to stack the dishwasher. So, you know, all of these things, you know, we manage.
I would
in
say
a way
the answer is usually they haven't improved their ability to stack the dishwasher.
And that depends whether you think there's a right way to do it. So as human beings, we're very capable of putting the level of structure that we need into things on a regular basis. So some people will like to book a restaurant that they're going to a week in advance to know that they can turn up. Other people will like to walk down the street and just see what's going on. And if you're in a relationship with someone who thinks the opposite way, you find a way of compromising or a way of working it. And there's no reason that that can't happen in the world of work as well. So the idea that you get a cookie cutter approach that suits everyone, I think is completely insane. But that said, I recognize your point that people are different, but I think they're easily able to find that accommodation themselves. I think the difficulty you get, and if you take this one example again, is when people say, well, I don't need feedback. You're going to go, well, kind of like you probably do, actually. So that's when it's difficult, when you get to a manager who says, you know, well, I don't need it, so my people don't need it. And you kind of think, well, so there's a minimum requirement of an expectation, but not in how you do it, I think is where I'm getting.
Okay. Absolutely. And it's putting the human back in, isn't it? And really, I mean, how we look at that is, if we can give managers an understanding to themselves and give them some self-reflection and that ability to go, okay, well, maybe I don't need it to be motivated. I don't need feedback to be motivated, but actually I do need to be able to take it when I get critical feedback. But then give them the insight into their team so they can flex that approach. I think that's the key, isn't it? It's about giving managers the tools to be able to understand where, taking your example of the doodle pad, which team members might need more of the questions from the doodle pad and which team members don't, because actually they'll come to the table and they'll be happy to just have a free-flowing conversation. But I think what I'm hearing and what you're saying is that a lot of the over-process that we have in traditional organisations, it takes the human element out. It's almost like we become robots following a 10-step one-to-one process that we forget that actually you need to connect with people. You need to build a relationship. How do we get that person to feel like they can open up to you? How do we create psychological safety? And a lot of that is just in the nuances of conversation.
If you're interested in learning more about your own management behaviours and the behaviours of your team, click the link in the show notes to access a 14-day free trial of Perform.
I'm interested how you have seen that balanced, Neil, because I'm thinking about maybe some more traditional HR leaders that might be listening to this, and they're going, well, that's great, but actually, if I've got to report on stats to a board or C-level, I mean, you work in a big business, how do you balance that ability to have more flex and actually create really human-centric interactions between managers and their teams, but then still be able to get the right data to be able to report on the things that you need to report on?
Yeah, and I think this is comes back to this point of you're reporting on process, not on outcomes, right? And so if you're reporting on process, one of the big debates around the people profession isn't, you know, kind of, we want to be strategic and we want all of these things, and, you know, we want seats at the table and all of this stuff that everybody says, and then they go back to their comfort zone, which is reporting on process. Well, of course, you're never going to get, you know, any of those things if that is the level of your focus and your concentration. And so, you know, kind of, why do we do these things? Because we want the security of saying we've done the input rather than saying, how are we driving the output? So what are we trying to do as an organization? What are we judged on as an organization? You know, and it doesn't have to be financial metrics, because some organizations, obviously third sector and, you know, public sector, will have different motivations as well. But what is our core purpose? What is the work that I do, and how does that link to the purpose and the outcomes that we're trying to do? And it's a really simple way of just coming back and saying, does this activity actually then contribute to what we're trying to do and what we're trying to deliver? And does it make us get there quicker or better or more easily? And if it doesn't, then reporting on it isn't going to be any help. It's just going to be a comfort blanket that you get that says, I've got some data on, you know, whatever it is. And so, you know, I think the two things are intrinsically linked, this desire to be more strategic and the desire to have more influence, and this letting go of some of this measuring process, you know, and trusting yourself that if you spend your time on other things, actually all these other good outcomes will come from it. And you can do that in any organization, right? You can kind of, you take construction, you know, and it's very simplest form. I'm not talking about large, you know, capital programs, but if, you know, you're trying to build a wall, right, that's the outcome that you're trying to do. You know, what do you need? You need enough people in order to be able to do that. They need to have the tools that they need in order to do that. They need to be able to have the safety environment to make sure that they don't hurt themselves as they do it. You know, they need to understand what height it's going to be, what length it's going to be, what depth it's going to be. All of these things, they don't need to have a conversation every day to say, how many bricks have we put in the wall, right? That doesn't necessarily drive the outcome. And so I think it's possible to do that in any organization, any environment, to come back and say, is this driving the outcomes that we are here to do? Or is it managing something that it wouldn't matter if it wasn't there?
What I'm taking from that, and we definitely see some of this in, to be honest, not so much the organisations that we work with. There's probably a reason for that, because our product is a bit more innovative, and so we tend to align with organisations that want to do something differently. But what we definitely see in the industry, I think, as a whole, is I would almost call that, it's like fear-based reporting, isn't it, almost? It's like, well, if I say that we have done 100 appraisals this year, I can't get into trouble if the team aren't engaged, for example, or if we're not promoting. Well, actually, that's a reporting on a process as a backup versus actually going, well, strategically, why are we doing appraisals? What's the reason for that? Is there a different way to do that? And if we're focused on an outcome, let's actually just focus on that one thing as opposed to all these things that we, they're almost like backups to that. They're to be able to say we did something versus actually focusing on solving the real thing that you want to solve.
I think that's absolutely right. And so we get this kind of discomfort blanket. It's like, you know, it's the equivalent of putting on your lucky socks, isn't it? You know, ultimately, there is no scientific or empirical data that says that those socks will drive any outcome. But we kind of do it because we just end up in a weird belief system. And, you know, succession planning is a really good example of what you're talking about, is people will go through this process of, you know, pulling together a succession plan and putting names in boxes and doing all of this. And you're kind of like, well, why are you doing it? What's the outcome that you want from it? And then do you test ever, does that process actually drive the outcome? So you know, if your outcome is we always want to be able to appoint someone from within our organization, well, great. You've got a bunch of data there that says over the last 5 years, have you been successful in doing that, right? Or not, right? It's really, really simple. And therefore, has that activity actually driven the outcome, or has it not driven the outcome? Is it just giving you a crutch to say, well, I've done the thing, but it's not connected? And if it isn't driving the outcome, then you can have a really good kind of challenge to yourself that says, well, how might we re-engineer this in order to make sure that we get a better outcome?
And one of the things that I think is difficult, and you alluded to it earlier, was just this getting the balance right between what's right, what we need from an organisational standpoint and what employees need. And you've talked quite a bit around that, bit around, you know, managers are doing a job and they're doing it, it's no rehearsals, there's no practices for it, you're doing it in real time and mistakes are going to happen and it's live. And often managers are put in a position where they don't have a lot of experience in that. So I think, you know, one of the things that we've got to recognize is that actually, in order for managers to be able to do some of the things we're discussing, is they do need support to know how to tackle those things, because often they're fastballed in the moment and it can feel quite tricky to navigate. What's your thoughts around, I mean, I love that idea of like really imagining that a manager is, you're literally doing this stuff in real time. It's one of the reasons why we've created our platform so people have got real time access to a coach in the moment. They don't have to book it 3 weeks in advance if they've got an issue. They can pick up, you know, they can DM us or pick up the phone and ask us questions in real time. Because often by the time you get to speak to someone 3 weeks down the line, you've suffered all the stress and anxiety during it, post it, and potentially haven't tackled the issue head on in the right way or the best way that you could. So I think the idea of that is such an interesting concept. I've not really thought of it in that way. When I was reading your blog, I was like, yes, this is it. This is, managers are actually in that position. How do we help managers and support them in that growth area to be able to deal with that those situations better?
Yeah, and you know, we've been talking about kind of process as props a little bit, and I think this is the case with a lot of managers. You know, you kind of go, you know, here's a bunch of process that you follow to be a good manager, and if you follow it really well, you know, then tick. But of course, as we all know, that's not what any of us will ever have experienced with a great manager. If we all think about a great manager, none of us will say, oh, they always followed the process really well and they filled all the forms out.
Usually, like, they didn't follow the process, well, did they?
Well, right, exactly. Yeah. So you then come back to, so how do you help managers? And the point with it, it's a theme in this conversation. You come back to, what's the outcome you're trying to achieve? What do you want from this, right? So you know, when a manager's got an inflection point, it's kind of like, what would be a great result for you? And then how do you help them to self-serve, to learn how to get that result out of that situation, rather than simply say, follow these 10 steps, because the 10 steps won't, they're learning to follow 10 steps. They're not learning to achieve an outcome And I think that's the kind of key difference. And what that needs is probably more discussion, coaching, more conversations, more reflection, you know, mentoring, all sorts of stuff, rather than simply, you know, we've systemized a process, which is where lots of organizations go, and you kind of go, oh, you know, you log on here and you follow this. Well, nobody's ever going to learn anything from that. So, you know, you get a lot, and a colleague will talk to me and they'll say, oh God, you know, so-and-so's doing my head in. And you go, okay, so you know, what do you want? Do you want them to leave? Do you want them to, now, you know, and then you have a really good coaching conversation at the end of it. They go, I just need to tell them, don't they? And you're like, probably, yeah, right. And, you know, instead, you could have pushed them off to say, well, if they're doing their head in, you need to set the objectives, and then you need to go back and you need to do that. And you know, if you're doing it in real time, and you could do a kind of analogy of football, you know, is quite often or rugby. One of the, you know, one of the pieces I was reading recently was, you know, you can learn set pieces in training, but when you're playing the game, sometimes you need to freestyle, right? And that's just the way it is. And I think, you know, with management, they need to freestyle on a regular basis, because there are fewer set pieces that actually apply. And this is a point I was trying to make in that article, which is they only learn by stuff going wrong in real time. They can't go to a training pitch and try out a maneuver and see how that works. And, you know, maybe say, oh, you can do that in the training room. But you're a manager for 40 hours a week, and you're in a training room maybe for 3 hours a year, right? So that equation doesn't work out. So I think it is just about helping them to go think about outcomes, and then think about and reflect on what they could do to get the outcome, rather than simply giving them props to follow in a process.
I love that. I love that idea of, like, you can give them some set pieces, and you can actually get them to practice the set pieces, so they get some muscle memory almost, and then they build some, maybe some new habits around a certain set way. But ultimately, in the moment, you have to be able to freestyle and think on your feet.
Well, 70% of it's action-driven, isn't it? I mean, in reality, 10% is the learning bit. And actually, we need to give them some foundations, because too many managers, I mean, that stat that haunts us of 82% of managers just get promoted with no support whatsoever. We need to give them some training as a foundation. But I think the problem is too many people don't see the training as a foundation. They see it as, we put them on a program and suddenly they'll leave the program and be better. And it's like, it doesn't happen like that. You need to give them some principles, but actually most of it's action, learning, coaching about the action, lessons learned, reflection, and then you go back on the loop again. So where have you seen technology work for some of this, Neil? Because I think, again, you know, most businesses are moving to integrating more tech, and a lot of that creates tech enablement, which makes things quicker, but it can also create just lots more processes and lots more things to do. So how have you balanced that in the organizations that you work in, and how do you discern when a technology is good from an HR and people perspective, and actually where do you think that it enhances, and where have you seen it not work so well?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, the question of technology is what you're trying to achieve with it. Again, it comes back to, you know, it might be simplification. It might be, you know, reducing the amount of time that people are spending on. It might be giving better outcomes. But sadly, I think too often, and probably, you know, I'm guilty of this as well, it's taking what you do right now, putting it into a technology platform, and putting together a business case that says it's going to save you some costs that you never ever realize, and you just actually create more misery through it. So you know, if you look at the amount of technology that probably, you know, we would all use in our daily life, and the quality that has, you know, Google Maps is a great example. You just flip that on, and it you know, it helps you by basically just navigating you to where you want to be. You know, nobody reads a paper map anymore. You know, nobody actually looks up anymore, which is, that's a whole other conversation, right? But you know, but it's become so integrated because it's so simple. If you compare that to enterprise technology is just so way off that kind of level. But I think where it can be brilliant, and where I've seen it being brilliant, is when it takes specific, relatively small area. So whether that is assessment, whether it's engagement, whether it's a particular part of development or training, when it's quite clear of what it's trying to do and generates value by helping people to do that simple activity better. But end-to-end enterprise technology, I think it rarely does that because it just takes what exists, puts it into a process, and therefore, instead of doing it on a piece of paper, you're now doing it on a keyboard or you're doing it on a mobile phone. And that obviously doesn't have that outcome-driven focus that you're trying to do. So to give you kind of two examples, very, very early on, I was an adopter of video interviewing technology. And what I really liked about this was it allowed managers to do interviews when it suited them in and around their time. So these were pre-recorded, but it meant as a manager, you were able to kind of shortlist in fits and starts over a period of time. You weren't having to allocate it. And that could be at night, that could be in the morning, that could be on the tube, it could be on the train or the bus or whatever you're doing. So it had, and it similarly for the candidate, it allowed the candidate to do the same. They didn't have to take a day off work or didn't have to travel to a location, et cetera, et cetera. So it was like mutually beneficial for everyone involved. Now, I'm not necessarily suggesting that solution, but what I'm saying, it had an outcome that was clearly focused on improving the quality of experience for lots of people rather than simply taking a, here's what we do at the moment, and we're going to put it on the technology. And I think that's when things get better.
I think that's a great example. And I think, you know, you can, even just talking about that in isolation, you can see the different benefits. I mean, even just, we all have the pain of trying to arrange meetings and trying to find mutual times on different calendars, and interviewing is one of those big ones. And I think that's really synergistic with when we built the platform. You know, we've had questions of people say, well, why is it just for middle managers? Why is it not for the whole organization? And it's a very similar answer to what you've just given of, we solve a very specific problem. And could we go and open this up wider? Well, absolutely. But actually, the things that we've heard of those, just a learning platform that's for everybody, you get lost in the content. There's hundreds of thousands of different ways to learn. You get non-specific stuff. Like it's that. So I think that as a benchmark for HR leaders to think about from a technology perspective is, what's the sole outcome? If you could think of one, who's the one audience that you're serving with this? What's the one thing that you want to do? And how does it make it better? Versus, we actually had a conversation internally, not within Perform, but within the role that I do from the people in HR side, about looking for a system that did everything, an HR system. And my question and challenge back was like, but why? Because they will be good at one thing. If you get an HR system, usually they're good either at the HRIS stuff, they're good at the talent mapping bit, they're good at the LMS. Very, very rare that you get a platform that's great at all of those things. And actually, I'd rather go and find 5 different platforms, but that solely do one thing really well. And these days, you can get a way for them to integrate so that we don't have to have millions of logins. But I think too often we're looking at, well, let's just find one that does everything and actually doesn't solve the issue.
I think that's right. And I think this is one of the areas where we're not thinking about AI well enough, actually, because I think this is a really big opportunity in terms of people experience. So if you imagine that you could go into one interface in your organization and say, I'm a middle manager and I'm looking for development and I'd like to learn these things. Now, and it doesn't care whether you've got one system or a billion systems in your organization, it can then take you to the right point. So from the employee, the experience is really simple because I go to one assistant that is going to help me navigate around the systems that exist within the organization. For the organization, it means that it can have best in class at a billion different systems, obviously not a billion, but I'm using it for exaggeration. And you don't have that saying, but how will people find the right one and how will they navigate to it and how will they do it? So you start to go, well, hang on a sec. That is a brilliant way of creating a way better experience for an employee and for organizations to make sure that instead of going, well, we'll just buy one because it's simple, because then we've only got the one. Well, it doesn't matter in that circumstance because they can all sit in different places and you can find it. And then you can go, oh, you know, I've just done that development. Could you add that to my training record? And it can then add it to your, so this gives us a real ability to start to think about that experience, but that technology differently. And I think there's a real opportunity there.
Oh, well, if you've got time to start a business, let's... Any tech people listening, there's an idea for you.
Just to finish off, Neil, I'm just conscious of time. We were looking at your profile earlier and it's very obvious to us from your profile. You're obviously a guy who is super curious, who likes to drive new ways of thinking about things, look at ways of developing things and improving them. And you've definitely got a big dollop of that from your profile around, you know, wanting to be a disruptor of the way people see the future. So just wanted to finish off around like your viewpoint on the future of work. So you've talked about that fundamental link between education and employment. And how businesses kind of prepare for that the future way. What do you think needs to change and how we kind of develop talent to ensure that organizations can succeed moving forward?
Yeah, so one of the things I would say is the future of work was yesterday, of course. You know, yesterday was at one point in time the future of work, and today, you know, at one point in time was the future of work. So what I think we've got to be careful of is making a proclamation about how things are going to be, because, you know, the reality is that, you know, none of us really know or understand. But I think where you can prepare people best, if you think about human evolution, we have developed brilliantly over hundreds and hundreds of years to be able to do so many different things without a training program in order to do it. We've learned to drive cars, we've learned to fly planes, we've learned to do so many different things over time. And how have we done that? We've done that by embracing the natural kind of curiosity and intellectual power of human beings. And I think the future of work is driven by doing that, getting out of the way of that and allowing people to find solutions to situations and to problems and to be able to drive those themselves. And there is lots that we can do to facilitate that and to create that environment where employees and managers are skilled and empowered in order to do things without massive intervention in order to try and manage it or measure it. And I think the future of work is one in which we do that. We are more human-centric and we are more trusting and empowering of people to deliver outcomes. Now, there's a massive caveat that I have on this, which is that cannot just be for white, wealthy, educated workforces. That has to be for all. And I have a real worry that we're seeing this separation between knowledge workers, where we're all talking about empowerment and freedom and, you know, trust, and then blue collar workers, where we're basically measuring and automating the living daylights out of their existence, and then wondering why we're struggling with social cohesion. So the other kind of facet for this is work has to become fairer, which means we need to talk about the outcomes for working class people as much as we need to talk about the outcomes for middle class and educated knowledge workers. And I think we have a real, real disconnect with that at the moment. And why is that important? It's important because that drives social cohesion, that drives economic productivity, that drives health and well-being outcomes, that drives future generational outcomes. So all of it is super important for the future and for big macro economic issues. But I worry that we spend so much time talking about one population and not the other. And so what does empowerment look like for a delivery driver, right? It doesn't look like being told that you've got 3.5 minutes to get 5 miles down the road. Otherwise, you know, you're not going to get your performance bonus. Or do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, how do you take those conversations into work for all rather than work for people who sit in offices? I don't know the answer.
No, and I think it's a systemic issue, isn't it? And it's one that, you know, you go into offices and they're having very different experiences. You know, that a lot of the initiatives that organizations create are for those people that you sit alongside every day, as opposed to the people who work out in the field, work on a shop floor, work out on the roads, whatever that may be. So I think that's a really lovely message for people leading organizations where you have a much more diverse workforce that are doing lots of different types of work. Actually, when you're thinking about pillars for your culture, how are you making sure that those pillars cross all of those borders and aren't just for the people that you might sit next to on the desk every day?
But and also to think outside of your organization too. Yeah. You know, not just to think internally about what you're doing, but also to think more broadly.
For sure. Impact wider. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We have loved having you here and thank you for taking the time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Nia.
So let's wrap up with some takeaways. The first has to be less process and more outcomes. And Neil really advocates for a minimalist approach with that question of what's the least we need to do to get the best result. Really encouraging you to strip back process and bureaucracy in favor of driving meaningful outcomes. We then talked about empowering managers to navigate in real time so that your training should be giving managers the ability to practice set plays. And then you need to be able to then provide some infrastructure after the training that allows them to freestyle, so to be able to make those real world decisions, react to situations that come up, but that they then got an infrastructure for coaching or mentoring or group discussion to really be able to hone those skills. And finally, we looked at the concept of technology and that should really be not just about replacing something that you do in real life, which is what technology so often become, is it's just that we're doing the same thing that we did without it, but we're doing it online. But it really should be focused on simplifying, enhancing, actually be able to give us the opportunity to do something that we've never done before, needs to really create this all-round better solution to what you were doing before.
Thank you for listening to Misbehave. Follow us so you don't miss out on other episodes.